I wanted to say to Ari that your presentation was a smash hit, and I appreciate it very much. It is good to have you as a friend. It would be a bad thing to have you as anything else, and when you decide to run for Congress, let us all know. I have these things. I have the honor to introduce a person for a moment this afternoon from Paris. We like to support disabled people, and we have a person here who is a blind person, who is the deputy mayor of Paris, and I was showing him, the government of the United States recently minted a coin with Braille on it, and Braille is the name of the man who invented Braille. He lived in Couperet, which is a few miles outside of Paris, and so I was showing him the Louis Braille Bicentennial Commemorative Silver Dollar. Some people in the Congress, when we suggested that this bill be introduced, said, why, Braille, he was a Frenchman. This is the United States. We said, well, Braille is an international medium of reading, and we use it in the United States, and it has meant literacy and independence for millions of blind people, so we should have a coin, and now we have it. If you want it, you can get it from the Mint. It costs about $35 or something. I would like, therefore, for just a moment to introduce the mayor, the deputy mayor of Paris. This is Hamou Bouakaz. Mr. Bouakaz.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very confused because my English is a little bit old and I don't practice it at all, enough. So let me tell you how proud I am to be here and how happy I am to be hosted by your federation. The fight you lead every day is my daily fight also. As a deputy mayor of Paris, I am not responsible on disabilities. Not because I couldn't, but because I wouldn't. I don't want to be. I wanted to be in charge of something which has no common point with disabilities. You will tell me that everything has common points with disabilities, but I wanted to show that a blind person can be in charge of every topic, every subject concerning the life of a city like Paris. That's why I am in charge of the local democracy and the ONG life, I mean ONG help and NGO help and NGO funding. As far as local democracy is concerned, my target is to make everything for facilitate the participation of every person who live in Paris to the life of the city. For example, we have a lot of evolution on the urbanism of the life of the city. We target to build towers, we target to change some roads and some places. And for me, it is necessary to create the best conditions for everyone to have an idea of what will happen and to give his opinion of what could be better, what could be the good evolution. That's why I have given to the Municipal Council a chart which will be adopted next month. And this chart is very near from the Disability Act, you know, but it's a small Disability Act. It's something for the City Hall of Paris. So I will not be long because you have a lot to work. I just want to tell you that equal rights and equal responsibilities is the good fight, is the good target to reach for every blind, sensitive person. And I just hope to have several occasions to work with your federation to compare the situation of our both countries, of our cities, and to create a sort of emulation in the world to realize the dream of an ideal world built for everyone, where everyone could take his place without taking account his disability or every other component of his personality. Thanks for all.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. This afternoon, Mark Riccobono, who is the Executive Director of the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute, is going to chair the meeting. And he is because I'm expected in a meeting in California tomorrow morning. I'm going to San Jose, and I know you think I'm not really going to a meeting, but I am. Well, I might be. I'm supposed to land and take off in Denver, and if there really are 30 inches of snow, I don't know whether it will happen. But on the off chance, I'm supposed to leave here at about 4:30, and to be sure that we have a person to chair this afternoon, here's Mark Riccobono.
Thank you, Dr. Maurer, and welcome, everybody, again to the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute. We're really pleased to have this second annual Jacobus Tenbroek Law Symposium. Well, let's move right into the afternoon because we do have a lot of interesting work to do yet. We've already heard some about the next topic, so it's a fitting topic, and the next panel will be the international impact of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And we have heard quite a bit about this. We know it's a key issue that a lot are concerned about. Our lead presenter for this item, Sherard Quinn, who is the Professor of Law and Director of the Center on Disability Law at the National University of Ireland. He headed the delegation of Rehabilitation International to the UN Working Group in 2004 that produced the main working document of the convention. Currently, Professor Quinn is directing research for the European Commission, that's mapping the UN Convention to the European Union law. Here is Professor Quinn.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor and a privilege to be here today. I must say my main accomplishment in my youth was I was an All-Ireland champion accordion player, which in my culture at least is much more important than academic distinctions. I must say the best time I ever had in the United States was playing with some bluegrass guys down in North Carolina. Anybody here from North Carolina? Great place. Picking up from what Mark Maurer said this morning, it is said very often that law is too important to be left to lawyers. And indeed, there was a very famous legal realist at Yale Law School, of course it would have to be at Yale, Fred Rodel, who once wrote that the practice of law should be made a criminal offense. Naturally, I disagree. I disagree not simply because it comes from Yale, but also because the sentiment emanates from overworked stereotypes. But I disagree mainly because on occasion, maybe only on some occasions, but on occasion, law intersects with ethics, with our better side. As Holmes once said, it's the outward repository of our values. And to live in that intersection where law intersects with ethics to produce justice is very inspiring, but it also leads to practical change which affects the lives of many. And that's why you're here today, and that's why I'm here today. And to see a theory of justice embodied in a single text, in a single instrument, in a single piece of law, gives confidence, gives one confidence in the possibility of seeking justice through law. And that's precisely why, and we have to remember it, it's precisely why the Americans with Disabilities Act, warts and all, detours to the Supreme Court and all, lit a fire that spread very rapidly throughout the world. And so it is with the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. I once wrote that while disability rights is an American invention, it's now truly a global challenge. So I want to talk in part about why such a convention was deemed necessary. And as usual, there's a very formalistic answer that doesn't really get at the essence of the convention. I'll give you a very different answer to the traditional lawyer's answer. And I will suggest that the real added value of the convention lies in its ability to trigger a new kind of disability politics worldwide. That's admittedly a very non-legalistic answer to a legal question, but I think it holds the key to the future of disability law reform throughout the world. I wonder, could I have a glass of water or something, please? Your Canada Dry. Even though we're in the US, I'll have some Canada Dry. It's probably made in the US. I think without this dynamic of change, one that can sustain itself will not really see change happen throughout the world, and certainly in the small places where people with disabilities actually live. And I also want to talk about the future, about how to optimize this potential and our collective responsibilities in this regard, by which I mean European and American collective responsibilities. The new dynamic of change won't happen because the convention simply exists. Beware of this temptation of elegance. Treaties are not self-executing. Treaties initiate a process of change. And it's really down to us to make the process work. And change will only happen because the convention is the occasion that energizes us to become much more engaged in assisting others to find their own solutions. Thanks a lot, Kathy. So first of all, why was the convention necessary? And here I take my H2O detour. Thanks. And let me start from a very unusual departure point. With due deference to John Adams, you all know that Thomas Jefferson espoused a very peculiar or particular theory of republican government, a theory that both justified your revolution and that continued to inform his view as to the future development of this country. He may have been wrong, and certainly John Adams viewed him as wrong, but he certainly was steadfast in his view and in his vision. Yet even he did not or could not face the contradiction between declaring that all men were equal on the one hand and continuing the institution of slavery on the other hand. While his values were admirable, his application of them were flawed. Famously, he could not and did not face the contradiction, and that came much later with the Civil War amendments. Likewise, let me suggest that the issue in disability across the world has nothing to do with the integrity of our legacy values. They're fine. Instead, it has to do with the way in which these values were deflected, misapplied, or not applied at all in the context of disability. After all, we had an entire edifice of human rights values in the two United Nations human rights treaties, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And they were given further particular expression in what's called thematic UN treaties on women, on children, and on racial minorities. So it's a very fair question to ask why these treaties, which purported to be universal, did not, in fact, yield any benefit to persons with disabilities. Some will explain this by saying there were demand-side problems. Persons with disabilities themselves did not look to these treaties for validation of their claims and for just satisfaction. Some will explain it away by saying that there were supply-side problems, that the people appointed to the various treaty bodies were just not attuned to disability as an equality and rights issue. I remember once we did a study for the Office of the UN High Commission, and we put a questionnaire together for states, and one of the questions was, how many people with disabilities have you nominated to these treaty bodies? And the Office of the High Commission said, forget it, no point. We can tell you now, absolutely none. So I think there's a lot to these reasons, these argumentations, but to me there is a deeper reason. The discounting of persons with disabilities in popular culture was in fact reflected in the intellectual structure of these treaties, and especially in the way they were interpreted. It isn't just your Supreme Court. So at one level, there was no need for a new convention, since the existing normative instruments were at least capable of being applied in the context of disability. On the other hand, there was little prospect of this happening unless there was the prodding of a new international instrument, which is this convention. So to me, the main value of this convention, of this treaty, like the 14th Amendment, is that it forces us to face the contradiction between the myth system of our laws and its operation system, and to commit to close the gap. It is said that John Brown made it impossible for people to sit on the fence on slavery. After Harper's Ferry, you had to take a side. Well, the convention actually is our Harper's Ferry at the international stage on disability. It forces the international community to face that contradiction and commit to change. Holding that mirror up to society is very important. It seems that the default setting of nearly every culture in the world is to discount persons with disabilities without experiencing any sense of contradiction. Henceforth, because of the convention, it's no longer possible to explain away the exclusion on grounds of paternalism or a sense of misplaced welfare. So facing the contradiction is a beginning. What it should lead to is a roadmap for change. My own experience on the other side of the Atlantic, actually people who live in my city always say, next stop, Boston. Anyhow, my own experience on the other side of the Atlantic tells me that if the roadmap is bottomed on a realization of this contradiction, then it can be sustained even during rough patches. But if it becomes simply a technical process of reform, divorced from this underlying understanding, it will predictably stall. So I think before outlining how the convention creates space for this new dynamic of disability politics and reform, let me first address a threshold issue, which has to do with the value of international law in the first place, which I'm sure must be on your minds. Some will make very exaggerated claims for international law, that it can force recalcitrant states to conform, that it contains hard and fast norms that, if properly interpreted, lead to the one right answer on every question. I don't believe this, and in actual fact, very few public international lawyers claim this. True, international courts like the European Court of Human Rights can have a dramatic impact, but that court has spent decades building up its institutional legitimacy, and there is no court attached to this Convention on Disability. And as befits a convention that in its essence pivots on the equality idea, there will be many occasions when the language of the text restates rather than resolves some of these hard cases. There are others who will claim that international law does not exist at all in the sense that it can significantly drive state behavior. Rather, states comply when they want to and when it suits their interests to do so, and vice versa. This might be descriptively true in many instances, but to me, it doesn't mean that international law is robbed of all of its autonomy and potential to drive change. In any event, even if one were to take this very narrow view that state interests drive international law, it would certainly be true to say that it is in the interests of the United States to engage, because at least as Jefferson would have put it, espousing and spreading the concept of freedom is not just in your interests, it is your primary interest. To me, there is actually a third way of understanding international law and trying to get at its potential benefit. It is said that the socialization and enculturation can nudge meaningful change. In other words, states, or at least certain important actors within states, such as Karim this morning, can internalize the norms of the convention and work them into domestic agendas, especially those who are conscious of their country's international reputation. If a critical mass of key policymakers can be persuaded, then change can happen. And of course, the really interesting thing, fascinating thing to me, I'm sure there's a sociological explanation, about such policy breakthroughs is that even when there is significant domestic pushback, this resistance tends to fade through time, and the momentous change of today becomes simply part of the new orthodoxy of tomorrow, making further change easier. But how can we ensure this persuasion and socialization? How can we, as it were, internalize the norms of the convention so that they can reflectively drive the process of change? One shouldn't rely on the fact that many state delegates, those who drafted the convention, were in fact persuaded or socialized during the negotiations, and most of them in fact were. Those delegates may become normative entrepreneurs within their own administrations, but very few of them return home to their capitals. So it's misplaced to rely on that simply occurring. To me, this can only happen if the convention is utilized cleverly, smartly, to create a new space, a new opening for a different kind of disability politics. So how can the convention crack open this space? Let me briefly highlight some features of the roadmap for change in the convention in terms of substance, but maybe more importantly, in terms of process. Benjamin Franklin also once said that he developed a lifelong aversion to drafting a text only to see it edited by a committee. Yet it has to be said that the text of the convention, which was produced by the ad hoc committee in the UN, seems to have survived reasonably intact and with a clear focus. It is not a traditional charter of substantive rights, and it is not just a bald non-discrimination instrument. It's a curious hybrid between the two. It's effectively an equal opportunities instrument at the international level, building on successful models under comparative law. It meets a long-standing demand of the disabled community to adopt and adapt the general human rights norms to which all are accustomed and tailor them to disability. It tailors traditional rights, for example, by ensuring that the dignity of persons with disabilities is respected by, for example, protecting them against violence, exploitation, and abuse. It tailors rights by giving power and autonomy back to persons with disabilities over their own lives, especially by restoring the capacity to make their own decisions and their own mistakes for themselves and to live independently. It adapts and tailors rights by focusing on the many, many, many different obstacles to participation, whether they're accessibility obstacles or other obstacles, and crafting very broad liberty rights to ensure these obstacles can be dissolved. And it also tailors traditional rights by ensuring that economic and social supports and services, far from being part of the problem as in the past, are now genuinely part of the solution. Persons with disabilities, just like all citizens, do not want welfare or other supports as compensation for not being in the mainstream. They do not want the support simply to survive. They need social supports re-engineered so that they can live active and productive lives. So from a substantive point of view, the convention elaborates a theory of equality and amplifies and clarifies the various rights to ensure that they were equally effectively available in practice to persons with disabilities. A key point needs to be made with respect to those rights, such as equal access to healthcare, that are both cost-intensive as well as time-dependent. Article 4.2 of the Convention is to the effect that such rights are to be achieved progressively. While this necessarily genuflects before economic reality, it is not a carte blanche for states. European jurisprudence, at least, interprets such an obligation to mean that there is the very least a dynamic of change in place going in the right direction, that the pace of change is meaningful and measurable, and that the negative impact of slow progress is fully taken into account, not just for those directly affected, but for others too. I submit this is a very significant consideration for the United States to take into account when weighing up its ratification. So much for substance. The process-based innovations are equally, if not more, striking, and that's what I really want to get at. How is this space for change, and what does the process envisaged by the convention crack open that space? At the international level, a new treaty body has been established, the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. It's actually been elected into office November of last year. It will assess state performance by reviewing periodic state reports. And by the way, when and if the United States ratifies, it's fully open to you to craft your own shadow reports that will go to this committee. It will also have the competence to entertain individual or group complaints, provided the relevant government opts into an optional protocol to that effect. It will, through its actions, clarify the norms of the convention. We in civil rights community and in national human rights institutions argued for something quite different, actually, to this, but the states reverted to this very traditional model of monitoring. Also at the international level, and this is quite innovative, there will be created, in fact, it's met already for the first time, a conference of states parties. And if you're not in, you can't win. If you've not ratified, you cannot participate actively in this conference of states parties. It is a very wide remit to exchange policy perspectives on anything relevant to the implementation of the convention. This has the potential to channel the collective efforts of states, and it is set to become the main clearinghouse in the world on disability law and policy, provided, and I underline the word provided, it has the right kind of leadership. This is why we need you at the international level. And for all of that, for all of the international innovation, it's the procedural innovations at the domestic level that are extremely remarkable. Oliver Wendell Holmes also wrote that to truly assess a new idea or a value or a legal instrument, you must first pour cynical acid over it and then see if anything remains. I'm often asked, what's the pulse of this convention? I used to reply that it resides in the shift between viewing persons with disabilities as objects to viewing them as subjects. But actually, it's much more than that. There are a lot of bad laws, a lot of bad policies and programs around the world on disability. And the rights and obligations contained in the convention will enable one to challenge those laws and policies. But that, at any rate, is a traditional lawyer's way of looking at the convention. I now tend to take a broader view of the convention and its potential to frame change. I believe you miss the point if you confine the convention to the traditional role of challenging bad laws and policies. To me, the most important potential of the convention resides in its potential to transform the process that leads to these bad laws and policies in the first place. One reason why bad laws were enacted in the past had something to do with the relative invisibility of people with disabilities in the political process. For one thing, as you well know, the opportunity costs of political participation are formidably high for persons with disabilities and their families simply struggling to survive. In addition, the policy process tended to work from a very narrow policy narrative, one that simply equated disability with cost and foreclosed serious analysis reform on that basis alone. The absence of the most important voices from the table meant that these deficiencies could not be readily undone. And the framers of the convention were alive to the fact that unless processes are changed, there will be little effective change in outcomes. We will keep repeating the mistakes of the past. The democratic system can right itself, but it can only do so with the full panoply of voices are at the table. That's why the mantra of nothing about us is actually now enshrined in Article 4 of the Convention. It requires active, ongoing consultation between government and persons with disabilities. To be sure, to govern is to choose, so this does not mean that persons with disabilities will always have a trump card at the table. But it does redress a fundamental flaw, and so measurably enhances the prospects of greater equity and better outcomes. There's another design flaw that the framers were alive to. International law exists out there in the ether. In general, there's no transmission belt to ensure that the fresh air of international law can reach into and revive the domestic reform process. You may score the odd victory in Geneva, but there the victory will remain. So the trick is to find some way of ensuring that the norms of the convention gain traction where they count most, in Dublin, in Lusaka, in Peoria. They have to become somehow owned by your administration and mine, and policy makers need to become motivated to see the symmetry between the convention and their domestic reform agenda. More importantly, policy makers should see themselves as giving back to the international arena. It's a two-way street, it's not a one-way street. So the framers of the convention actually took the next logical step by going beyond a simple listing of rights with a very traditional international system of monitoring that existed out there in the pure ether of international law. They envisaged, they put into place, they require states to put into place what I call a domestic institutional architecture for change under Article 33. This article, to me, lies at the very heart of the convention. It makes a stab at putting in place an architecture of change at home, in Washington, D.C., or in Dublin, that can transform processes which, if left untransformed, simply lead to more bad laws and policies, and the circle keeps going round. Article 33.1 demands the existence of a focal point as well as a coordinating mechanism within government. It gets at and seeks to unravel the silo phenomenon, whereby most governments in the world disperse responsibility for disability across many departments and even within departments. The predictable result is the tragedy of the commons, whereby no entity takes lead responsibility, and the chaos that ensues creates massive cracks through which ordinary people fall. Article 33 is truly innovative, all the more so when you realize that the convention requires that this government mechanism can only function if it consults actively with persons with disabilities. So far, so good. Something else is needed to ratchet a dynamic reform into place. Good governance is also about accountability, and accountability is not just an end in and of itself. It helps keep the reform process going in the right direction. It underpins and not undermines effectiveness. That is also why the framers of the convention took another logical step by requiring states to designate an independent body to promote, protect, and monitor progress in implementing the convention. You're going to have to do this too when you finally ratify the convention. The language is a bit open-ended, an example of what you might call constructive ambiguity, to bring along those governments, not your government, that do not see accountability in quite the same positive light. But the intention is very clear. The intention is to harness an independent body or a series of bodies in the process of ensuring that the norms are real and not rhetorical where it matters most in your country and in mine. Human rights commissions, civil rights commissions, national disability bodies, such as your National Council on Disability, will have to be at the fore of such domestic institutional architecture of change. I would suggest a first step in a rational process of designating this independent entity or series of entities could well be to map out which entities already do some of the work of promoting, protecting, and monitoring the implementation of disability rights at home. The triangulation at the domestic level is complete when one realizes that Article 33.3 also requires that the monitoring that is to be done by the independent body at home, in Washington or wherever, is to function in active consultation with persons with disabilities. Article 32 on international cooperation is going to be the key, I think, in helping to embed this dynamic of change, especially in those countries where disability has been neglected. It doesn't specifically require development aid to be increased or even earmarked. It does require that development should be inclusive of and accessible to persons with disabilities. To me, at least, this entails the proofing of development aid programs from a disability perspective. Just as important, it requires facilitating and supporting capacity building, which includes the sharing of information, experience, training programs, and best practices. And it also requires cooperation with respect to research as well as technical assistance. These are all assets that you have and that the world is crying out for you to share. To me, these process-based innovations hold the key to the success of the convention. So to my way of thinking, you underplay the significance of the convention if you simply view it as supplying a set of norms against which to measure bad laws and policies. Instead, I would encourage you to see it as an instrument that can transform the process that makes these bad laws in the first place. The convention does not simply impose obligations, it seeks to improve the democratic process by opening it up to voices that were hitherto excluded or discounted. You can only bring these voices to the table and trust the process to reach the right outcomes by active listening to and with persons with disabilities themselves. The very process of drafting the convention showed how useful and constructive that engagement can be. In my view, the key to the success of the convention will be in how well states can embed this domestic institutional architecture for change. The United States has been a global leader in disability for at least the last 20 years. Your legacy values, your civil rights tradition, continually forces people to confront the contradiction between myth and reality. And your focus on using law to underpin freedom and choice and not undermine it is inspiring. Europe, too, is in the middle of transforming its social model to accommodate a civil rights perspective in the field of disability. And that's especially liberating in the context of disability. So to me, the convention, if and when ratified by the US, should help reinforce law reform trends in this country. It does not fatally undermine your sovereign responsibilities. It helps align them with challenges faced elsewhere. If and when you ratify, it will at least be possible for the domestic courts to take the convention into account, among other factors, in the interpretation of domestic legislation. It's certainly a desideratum of the common law to interpret domestic law, if at all possible, in a manner consistent with your international legal obligations. As Justice Stephen Breyer in the Supreme Court would put it, it enables you then to have a meaningful conversation with the world at large as to common challenges. Furthermore, there is a significant margin of appreciation of the convention to allow discretion at the domestic level. And the concept of progressive achievement does allow sufficient latitude for the US and other states to begin laying the groundwork for social supports, including, for example, healthcare, to underpin this freedom agenda. Additionally, the new Conference of States Parties would appear to provide a unique platform to initiate a structured and serious sharing of ideas, experience, and expertise to trigger the law reform process worldwide. You gain, we all gain through such active participation on this. I know it can be, and it is being done bilaterally, but the impact would be magnified many times over through active participation by the United States on this new Conference of States Parties. You have invaluable experience with respect to your domestic institutional architecture for change. No sustainable process of change will happen throughout the world unless this is gotten right. Very few countries have this, and all are eager to learn. Article 33 on international cooperation provides a window through which to channel support for this process of change. To me, this isn't just about acknowledging about knowledge of laws and policies. It's probably more to do with the political entrepreneurship skills that civil society here has built up through the years, including not least the National Federation for the Blind. Maybe of interest to you to know what's happening very briefly at European level. You may be aware that the EU as such, separate from the member states, but as such has signed the convention and is set to ratify it by the end of this year. That means that the European Commission, which has sole prerogative to introduce European law, will henceforth be guided by the convention as to the legislative initiatives it brings to the European Parliament and the European Council. We are already seeing some examples of this, some draft legislation that's already quoting elements of the convention. Several European states that did not have national disability strategies have now adopted them, and bottom them explicitly on the UN Convention. New Zealand has done so. Australia is about to do so. So you're seeing a very clear alignment between the Convention and the structuring of national disability strategies. There is a very interesting process, I'll just mention it in passing, that I had a hand in setting up in the mid-90s when I used to work in the European Commission. It's called the Transatlantic Agenda, whereby your federal government and the European Commission share high-level policy perspectives on common challenges. We put disability into the basket, and there were some initial fruitful exchanges of views and learning going on, mutual learning between both sides. I would suggest to you that once the United States ratifies this convention, the transatlantic agenda should be kicked into life to really start a structured exchanging of good practice and knowledge and insights. I think it's also best to think of the convention as articulating a theory of justice that every citizen can subscribe to and in which every citizen has a stake in its success. It's about disability, but it's not just about disability. It's really about reminding ourselves of our legacy values and forcing us to face the contradiction. Ladies and gentlemen, President, some of you will know that Thomas Jefferson, when he lived in Paris, actually had a hand to play in drafting the French Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizens. He was a true internationalist. By committing to signing the UN Convention, President Obama has symbolized, at least to me, that America is back. We need your leadership more than ever on the disability field at the international level. And may I simply conclude by saying, may the spirit of Jefferson be your guide.
Before we get to questions, we do have one commentator on this panel, and that's Catherine Guernsey. Catherine is an attorney and adjunct professor at the American University School of International Service. She recently joined the United States International Council on Disabilities as their Director of Education and Outreach, overseeing their human rights education and outreach campaign related to the convention. Here's Catherine Guernsey.
Can you all hear me all right? Good, all right. First of all, thank you very much. It's a real honor for me to be here today, so I really appreciate the opportunity to participate today. I've been joking that my role as commentator for Gerard is both a curse and a blessing. A curse because Gerard is always such a tough act to follow, and a blessing because my remarks as a commentator can be very short, namely, Gerard, I agree with you. Nevertheless, as Mark said, I am an attorney and therefore given to opining, so I hope you'll forgive me if I spend just a couple more minutes with a few more remarks. Gerard makes a strong case for why the convention is needed, even with the existence of an international legal system that should have effectively served to protect and promote the human rights of people with disabilities around the globe. Gerard demonstrated the groundbreaking ways in which the treaty approaches implementation. In this regard, we should thank, I think, the ad hoc committee which drafted the treaty for having been open to borrowing from other areas of international law, especially environmental law, where mechanisms such as conferences of states parties have been used for some time. We do have a tendency, I think, in the human rights field to be somewhat insular, and we do occasionally operate in a bit of a vacuum. So I think we really owe the ad hoc committee for their openness to examining other fields of international law and borrowing from them liberally for our benefit. All of these mechanisms should not only serve to enhance implementation, but they should ensure that the treaty remains a vibrant and organic document capable of retaining relevance in a changing world. Beyond these issues, Gerard's articulation of the process-based and transformative mechanisms and benefits of the CRPD requires us, I believe, to reconsider what may be called the philosophies of ratification. There are two main approaches to ratification adopted by countries around the world. The first is to ratify and then worry about compliance later. This is often, although not exclusively, it is often the approach of many developing countries who have few resources for implementation. The alternative philosophy is to comply first, or attempt to comply first, and then ratify. This is often the approach of developed countries or more resourced countries, also referred to as the getting our ducks in a row first approach. Each approach has its own advantages and disadvantages. The first leaves countries violating the treaty, but helps to create the internal political will needed to effect change in order to achieve compliance. The second approach should ensure more compliant states' parties, although many a treaty body may disagree, but it can take a long time to achieve, and consequently, ratification and participation in the treaty processes is also delayed. The transformative mechanisms established by the CRPD could lead to an adoption of a third way, a third philosophy, namely, where you establish participatory mechanisms for review of the current legislative and policy context. And by participatory, I want to draw on our lunchtime speaker's comments that they should be inclusive of organizations of people with disabilities. So establish those participatory mechanisms for review of the current legislative and policy context, make common sense initial changes, then ratify swiftly with a view to fully leveraging the transformative benefits of being a state's party operating within the treaty system. For example, having ratified, a country can participate in conferences of states' parties, where international cooperation in the form of information exchange can illuminate innovative approaches to implementation. Commitment shown by being a state's party can lend legitimacy to requests by countries for technical assistance and aid, for example, requests to the World Bank or other multilateral donors. Furthermore, being a state's party can bolster the internal political will needed to establish and fully resource mechanisms to monitor human rights, such as the Article 33 body to which Gerard referred, and engage disability representatives in meaningful consultative decision-making mechanisms. By adopting this third way, I would argue that further implementation can be achieved more comprehensively, effectively, and dare I say, quickly. As we heard at lunchtime, overcoming stereotypes and myths takes time to effect. Internalizing the norms of a treaty takes time to take effect. I believe that this third approach is definitely worth considering here in the United States as we contemplate our own ratification of the treaty and our reassumption of our place in the world as a global leader in human rights. Thank you very much.
Hello, hello. Okay, do we have our microphone runners? Okay. All right. Well, who has the microphone?
Raise your hands. All right.
There we go. Guess the microphone's going over to Dr. Maurer.
Very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The ratification of the treaty. I think I understand that process. I heard Gerard say that there was no court to implement the treaty. My understanding was that once ratified in the United States, at least the court system in the United States is bound by it. And I wonder what the implementation process, as you understand it, within the United States and around the world might be, or if I've misunderstood what this treaty means, I thought once ratified, the courts had to take note of it and follow its provisions, at least the ones in this country, although I recognize that each country does not have a Supreme Court to tell it what its Supreme Court should do, so there might be different interpretations around the world.
Great question. Okay, be careful, because at least in common law jurisdictions like the United States, unless a treaty is directly incorporated into your domestic law, it's not easily invocable by litigants before your domestic courts. And most international human rights treaties are in fact not incorporated into domestic law, except in civil law jurisdictions where in practical terms it actually makes no difference, despite what civil lawyers will tell you. But there is at least a desideratum in common law jurisdictions, the US included, whereby at least courts are exhorted, domestic courts are exhorted to pay heed to one's international legal obligations, even if that treaty has not been incorporated, as a tool to interpreting domestic law. I guess the way it's put is that they should strive to avoid a needless clash between domestic norms and international norms, if possible. I mean, if it's not possible, they of course have to run with state sovereignty and pronounce that the domestic norms have priority. But even so, I think if, for example, in some of the interesting cases on the definition of disability, the US Supreme Court at least alluded to some of the international law trends, it might have made a difference in how they framed the issue and the kind of conclusion they arrived at. You will be aware of that ongoing discussion between Stephen Breyer and Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court as to the relevance of comparative law and when it can and when it cannot not be invoked. So at a minimum, we could say that at least it could be available as an interpretive tool in putting maybe a positive spin on some provisions in domestic law that were otherwise ambiguous. But it's not a killer argument in domestic courts, in any common law domestic court. There is no court attached to this convention. There's no court attached to any of the international human rights treaties. They're international treaty monitoring bodies. And I personally think that the main value of these bodies is they at least articulate some sort of jurisprudence, some sort of understanding of what the convention requires. One of the things that these treaty monitoring bodies do is they issue what's called, and this is just jargon, it's called general comments on the obligations of these conventions. I would imagine that this particular treaty body will be very careful to elaborate these general comments, number one, in alignment with the existing jurisprudence under the other treaties, because there is a danger that if they get too far out of whack with the other treaty bodies, that they will not be taken seriously in the UN system and in turn by the member states who ratify this convention. But I would expect over time that through these general comments there will be further and better articulation as to the actual obligations of this convention. So you may say, well, so what then? Is there any hard and fast driving mechanism? In a traditional legal sense, no, there isn't. There isn't a court that you can go to and seek damages or an injunction. But I think that's why we have to get back to looking at some of the procedural innovations that are critically important in this convention. And to me, you have the domestic architecture for change. Most countries don't have this yet. What's going to be interesting to me is the interaction between this domestic architecture for change and the convention to see what difference will it make to, for example, your National Council on Disability when it looks at an issue like deinstitutionalization. Does it give a particular spin to the advice it will give to your government and so forth? That's a very long-winded way of answering. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, to be quite frank.
Okay. Mike Bullis?
Thank you. Putting aside for a moment whether the United States ratifies the convention or not, which I can't frankly predict, are there significant portions that you would say to yourself we should incorporate into our law? In other words, are there things that are not now in our law that exist in the convention? Or are there things in our law that that the convention would in some way be opposed to or view as not as anathema in any way? In other words, are there contradictions between our law and the convention? And talk to those two issues, if you would.
I'm not a U.S. lawyer, so all I would say is that there are things in the convention that don't get framed as rights in the United States. For example, there's a lot of stuff on social and economic rights that although you have the ingredients of in your legislation, you don't actually conceptualize as economic, social, and cultural rights. To me, that's perfectly fine. How you actually deliver is up to you. As to whether there's contradictions between domestic law and the convention, do you want to say anything on that, Catherine?
I can a little bit, yeah. And I will also say that my personal belief is that here in the United States, where we traditionally have a very tepid view of international law in general and human rights law specifically, I'm very hopeful that we will achieve ratification of this treaty, but I'm also a realist. I like to view the treaty as a tool for change, and if we ratify, it's a bonus. So what is it about this treaty that can provide a tool for change? I think the standards that it outlines are very helpful articulations of the kinds of rights that we have been talking about for a long time and that are dotted about in various pieces of U.S. legislation at the federal and the state level. But I like the comprehensive approach of the treaty. I think it encourages us to take a holistic view of issues. We do sometimes tend to silo issues. Whereas the interrelated and interconnected nature of human rights forces us to look at, for example, employment not as a standalone issue, but in the context of the education mechanisms that train people so that they can be qualified for jobs, at healthcare mechanisms, at transportation mechanisms. All of these things are interrelated. That approach to disability issues is something that I think we can draw from in the convention and use to good effect. In terms of possible contradictions with U.S. law or gaps, Gerard has already noted that we have a philosophical gap in terms of our view of economic, social, and cultural rights. I, too, don't tend to practice domestic law, so I don't consider myself an expert on U.S. law. But there are a few things that will be challenging for us. For example, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has issued a report trying to fill some of the gaps that exist in the treaty language, to fill them out a little bit. Granted, that's not the High Commissioner's place within the international structure. That's up to the committee. But this is a helpful document. And as the High Commissioner's office supports, and as the Secretariat for the committee, I think we should be mindful of these comments. One of the comments that was made in the report was that the Article 12 provisions related to legal capacity may very well require the doing away with of the insanity defense. In other words, we should look not to the disability of the defendant, but we should look to the requisite mens rea for whether or not they can be said to have committed a crime. There are many criminal lawyers in this country who would very much be against the doing away with of that defense. And there are arguments on both sides of this, and I'm not purporting to support or counter that. I'm not proficient enough in the issues. But that is one example where there may be some inconsistencies. And these are not impediments to the U.S. becoming a states party. They're just issues that we need to talk through and to deal with, either internally or through our ratification process. And I should say, too, ratification exists at two levels. There's a domestic ratification process that is unique to all countries. The outcome of that process is the production of an instrument of ratification. It is not until that instrument is deposited with the Secretariat for a treaty that a country becomes a state's party to it. So just to clarify that, we've been bandying around the word ratification, and it occurred to me we never really defined it. So sorry about that.
Supplemental to that, a lot of countries have conducted internal reviews, just like Karim Dale was alluding to this morning. And most countries that have done this have actually published the outcome of those reviews as to where the gaps exist, if any, and how they're going to be redressed. It's important, I think, that that will be done here in an inclusive manner, that it will accurately finger objectively correct red flag issues. From my vantage point, I'm not in a position to tell you what they are in this jurisdiction. And to distinguish that from assumed red flag issues and to put the arguments together to dissolve them, and then to list the other issues that are kind of a bit wacky, and we all agree they're wacky, but unless you put language together to actually dissolve them, they're going to persist out there in the political context. It seems to me that that process is very, very important process. I would encourage the United States to do it inclusively and openly and publish the outcome.
Dan Goldstein? Oh, you don't have the mic yet. Got someone over here? Who is this?
Ari Naaman.
Go ahead.
Is this on?
Yeah. Yes.
Great. My question is, independent of the UN Convention, although perhaps supplemented by it, what do you think we can expect from both the U.S. State Department and other nations' foreign ministries and so on as far as being active advocates and watchdogs over disability-related abuse and discrimination in both the developed and developing world in the coming years?
Well, I will say, in the first instance, the State Department produces human rights reports addressing the human rights situation in many countries around the world. Now, some people would argue, well, who are we to be doing that? Who are we to be commenting on the human rights of other countries? Ought we not to be investing those resources internally? But for better or worse, we do produce these things, and they are actually often very well done. In the last few years, to their credit, the State Department have begun the process of being inclusive of disability issues. This came about as the result of a consultative process with civil society, with the National Council on Disability, who proposed questions that could be utilized by field researchers employed by the State Department who gather the evidence for these reports. And so these questions have helped to feed into the reports some components of disability. Now, I would argue that relative to the reports as a whole, the disability components are very small and often formulated by people who do not have a full appreciation of the issues to be able to gather the evidence in a full way. So that's something that we could certainly improve upon. Gerard, would you?
Yeah, three very practical things. Assuming, hopefully, touch wood, that President Obama signs maybe in the next few months, and hopefully, again, touch wood several times, that the Senate gives its advice and consent and ratifies, let's say, within 12 months. You then have a window to elect somebody to the new UN Committee on the Rights of People with Disabilities, because I think it's at least a third or half the members have a two-year term, and that will be up around then. So you better get your thinking hats on now as a community as to who you would ask or request the State Department to nominate to that particular body. Second thing is the agenda for the Conference of States Parties is wide, wide, wide open. It's completely up to you to put suggestions to the State Department as to what issues should be prioritized and then to get a real working program going on that Conference of States Parties. Also, when and if you ratify, let's say when you ratify, the transatlantic agenda, the high-level policy exchange program between the EU and the United States, you suggest to the State Department things that you'll want put in that basket. I would suggest to you things like marrying appropriate health care to disability, things like modernizing and individualizing service delivery to underpin non-discrimination laws, which the EU has a good track record on. So there are very many practical things that the State Department could do. It's not about naming and shaming exclusively. It's actually more about acknowledging that we're all developing countries when it comes to disability. And unless we step up to the plate and start helping each other, there's not going to be much by way of a process of change.
I'll just add one more thing. The United States has a very unique role in the international development field, given that we get to appoint the president of the World Bank, and we have a very significant role in the operations of the World Bank. we have an opportunity to encourage the World Bank to adopt safeguards policies and other policies to ensure that their development projects are conducted in a manner that is inclusive of disability. By the terms of the agreement that establishes the World Bank cannot act in a way, is not supposed to act in a way, that would cause client countries to violate their own treaty obligations. So that's one level that of protection that exists already. But the World Bank as an entity has the potential to be a real mover and shaker in these fields and ensuring that developing countries who are the client countries, that they are resourced to really implement their treaty obligations. So I think we as the United States do have a very unique role to play in influencing the World Bank given our donor status and also the presidency of the World Bank.
Played that role in the past in regards to encouraging nations to protect the rights of minority groups, or would that be sort of an unprecedented new role for the bank to take?
It wouldn't. We can argue about the effectiveness of the safeguards policies, but there are safeguards policies with respect to indigenous peoples, with respect to forcible resettlement of people. There's not a safeguards policy, but there is an operational policy with respect to gender. Which those who operate in that field would say is not well enforced, but relative to disability, it's a shining star. So there is precedent, for sure. So it is not something that would be completely out of the blue.
Can I come back on that? Because the development aid budgets of countries and regions actually dwarfs the World Bank. For example, the EU has the single biggest development aid budget in the world. So it really matters a lot that the EU ratifies this convention, because then the obligations of the convention will tack onto its development aid budget. In truth, there's only about 6 countries in the world that are actually making first efforts to ensure that their development aid programs are tailored to people with disabilities: Norway, Australia, Germany, the United States haltingly, but hopefully very much more robustly. None of them know how to do it. That's the problem. And that's why they need to start exchanging perspectives on how to do this. Peter Blank's Institute hosts the Global Partnership for Development and Disability, which is a beginning, really. And I think you're seeing those green shoots happen, and it's going to take some time for them to lead to something.
Okay, I think we have time for Dan Goldstein's question before our break.
Thank you. It's really more of a comment. I wanted to underline what Professor Grinzi said about the value of having a holistic statement where domestic law may be scattered. To me, a primary example of that I think it's Article 9, is the statement of the right of access to electronic information as a fundamental human right. That's an incredibly powerful statement. We don't have that in one place in American law. And even though I'd rather have it as domestic law and something we could sue on, in the meantime, it helps legitimate what we're saying. It's very powerful to say to a corporation, do you understand that what you are doing is something that 67 countries all agree is a violation of a fundamental human right? And if you happen to be saying that to somebody who's in their PR department, they start to get chills and shakes and get very nervous, because being called a human rights violator is not usually terribly good for business. So this is a very powerful tool, even if it isn't quite as powerful as we'd like yet.
Sure, who? Okay, go ahead.
This is really just off of your EU comment, and I guess some comments about how is American law a bit different. And I think the education Article 24 is pretty groundbreaking in its inclusive education, which has never been put in an international document. It's not what we have in our law. We have least restrictive environment, which is very different than what inclusive education is. You had mentioned, though, specifically with the EU, that they've signed and that they plan to ratify. Education is not something that the EU is competent. It's not one of the EU competencies. which I think is kind of interesting because I think it directly relates to employment. Is that something that you foresee in the future will occur? Because as it is right now, I mean, I the majority of EU states don't have inclusive education. Some of them don't even have any sort of education provision in their law for kids with disabilities.
Very interesting question. I think, well, just before I get to that, the whole point about the convention and the holistic approach is that it's actually forcing a number of countries that's never had national disability strategies to draw everything together to do it, including some rich European countries and including some dirt poor European countries. Moldova is the latest European country to adopt a national disability strategy. Average income is $30 a month, which proves you don't have to be rich to actually make put in place the right steps in the right direction. So I think that is one of the positive advantages of the convention. You're quite right to say that education is not a federal competency, if I can use that word, at EU level. Of course, I spoke about Jefferson, so I can't speak about federalism. But here's what happens. When the EU does not have a legal competency, normally speaking, if coordination between the states is of European-wide significance, the EU puts in place a method of coordinating activity between the states on particular issues. They have, it's called, this is jargon again, the open method of coordination, which they have in place for social inclusion and poverty reduction and something else that I can't remember. I think what the EU is thinking of doing is putting something equivalent in place to make sure that UK education disability law is broadly speaking in line with French education law on disability and so on and so forth. The optimist in me thinks that perhaps down the road that will lead to what is called exportability of social benefits, that you'll be able to carry with you your independent living social supports in Germany to attend a college in Greece and vice versa. So even though the EU as such doesn't have legal competency in those fields, it will be putting in place the mechanism to harmonize, coordinate, and make sure that they can at least eliminate some of the glaring gaps between the laws and policies of the member states. Kathy was just reminding me, maybe, perhaps, possibly, you could get at some of the issues through the non-discrimination tool. I don't know if you know, but in 1997, the EU treaties were changed to afford it a measure of legal competency in the field of non-discrimination. There was a race directive adopted, very wide-ranging race directive, which reaches issues like housing, social goods, social services, which are not really EU-level competencies. But the danger is the European Court of Justice may well pick up on some of the Alabama and Garrett rhetoric in your Supreme Court and begin saying there's a limit to the extent to which you can use the non-discrimination tool to peer into fields that you actually lack treaty-based competency. So that remains one of our 64 million euro questions, the extent to which our court may emulate some of the worst decision-making processes in your Supreme Court. That's why our lawyers are really interested to learn about strategic litigation strategies at US level mapped onto the EU. I'm sorry, I moaned on a bit. Sorry.
Catherine, did you want to add anything?
No, as I said, when commentating on Gerard, it's easy. I just say I agree.
All right. Well, we are at our time limit, so thank you very much again to Professor Quinn and Catherine Guernsey. We have a break now until 2:45. We have two more panels and lots more discussion to be had. So we'll see you at 2:45.